Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jesse Lasky. He's currently assistant professor at Penn State University. His work explores how the environment and human modifications of the environment affect biodiversity at the level of genetics and ecological communities. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
It's my pleasure.
So I guess the first question is, you've done work on walls and fences, and just can you talk about, on the most basic level, how do walls and fences affect the natural world? What do they do to individuals and communities?
So the fences and walls can have a few different impacts. And these impacts differ depending on the kind of organism we're talking about and also depending on the time scale we're talking about. And I can give you a little overview of them.
That sounds great.
So for a shorter time scale, one of the things that we're concerned about is the day-to-day movements of large organisms that often move pretty far across our landscape. So large animals, things like pumas, jaguars, bighorn sheep, black bears. These are animals that are pretty charismatic, and they usually often move far distances to find food, to find water, and mates. So any individual needs to move over a large area, and if that movement is stopped across a large portion of where they live, then they might not be able to find enough food, they might not be able to find enough water. So they might have a hard time making a living, and so you might see those populations decline relatively rapidly. So that's sort of a short-term impact because of the day-to-day livelihoods are impeded for those kind of organisms. That's something that we're concerned about in the region of the border where there's been a lot of construction of walls and fences, and where they've certainly talked about doing more of that. And then moving to a sort of longer term view, one of the things that we're concerned about is if there's a lack of movement of organisms across the landscape, that might lead to extinction of those organisms. And one of the reasons why we're concerned about that is that many species, especially things that are often fairly rare already, some of these species often live in fairly isolated populations. And so any given population might be vulnerable to disturbances, things like diseases or storms, a variety of things might come in and wipe out an individual population, but if there's dispersal across a landscape, those populations can be refounded by new colonists from other populations. And that sort of continual renewal process is key to the survival of many species. So if you really reduce the dispersal of organisms across landscapes, that can be a major problem for their long-term persistence. In addition to that demographic issue there that's sort of related to this refounding of populations, we also have concerns that are genetic in nature. And so that sort of looks like the situation where you've got populations that are isolated and they start to lose genetic diversity. This is because genetic diversity is really one of the, or dispersal across the landscape is one of the major sources of genetic diversity for populations. And so if they lose that source of diversity, you might imagine that they could have a harder time adapting to changes in the environment over time, like climate change, if there's no genetic diversity in a population. Also over time, these isolated populations can have issues with inbreeding depression, where you have close relatives mating with each other. And one of the sort of poster childs in conservation of that in the United States is the Florida panther, which is this isolated, pretty small population in South Florida of the puma, and there are diseases that became prevalent because of inbreeding. And so one of the things they did was brought in pumas from Texas to mate with them to provide some genetic diversity and to try to, and that helped cover up some of those lethal diseases or those genetic diseases. So that movement of organisms across the landscape can be really essential for that long-term persistence for those genetic reasons as well. And those are sort of the issues that we have with animal movement, where we're concerned about impeding movement. But we're also concerned with direct impacts that barriers have, because in constructing the barrier, whoever's constructing a barrier, a wall, a fence especially, these kind of big barriers require a lot of construction equipment. And they also often in places where you have steep terrain, you know, mountainous areas, which there are many of, many areas along the border are like that. Those kind of areas, the construction itself requires you to build roads and is really, disturbs a fairly large swath of the landscape directly, you know, so the native vegetation is removed. Or sometimes you have, things like what happened in the, California coastal, mountains where an entire canyon was filled in with dirt so that they could build the fence across the canyon. So those kind of direct impacts of fences and walls, like the construction of them is the other part of it. And that's not actually just the construction. There's also, once they are constructed, the Border Patrol often likes to have a road maintained along the fence. And sometimes they put up stadium lighting, and keep vegetation away from the barriers. So those disturbances also we're very concerned about.
So to be clear, when you're saying the wall, you're talking specifically about, the border between the United States and Mexico, but you're also talking about the effects of walls in general, correct?
Yeah. So everything I've really been talking about here is general. But we've studied this specifically, in the Southwest along the U.S.-Mexico border. But these are general issues with barriers that stop human movement or these large construction projects.
So a few directions to go. One of them is that, I don't remember the name of him. He's a very famous biologist in the 1990s wrote a book about island, basically island conservation and how if you fragment habitat, was it Michael Soule? I don't remember who it was. If you fragment habitat, you can basically then, if you're going to model the population behavior, it may be kind of like they're on an island and they can't intermix. So it sounds like, at least on one level, on the demographic level, it sounds kind of like that's what you're talking about too, that the walls create these barriers that could be the same thing as 20 miles of ocean.
Yeah, that's a common perspective to take on trying to understand what's going to happen to populations that are in different parts of the landscape where humans have sort of made the intervening part, what we call the matrix, really hard to move through. You know, that's a common way we study it is sort of making that analogy with islands because movement is so difficult.
So before we focus on the border between the United States and Mexico, can you talk about, I'm very ignorant on this. Are there other major walls around the world that have had devastating effects? I mean, I'm presuming the Great Wall of China had big effects on migratory creatures. Or are there other ones that have been studied? I read about a big wall in Namibia that caused lots and lots of animals to starve or die of thirst because they can no longer get to their water holes. Are there other examples that we know of?
Yeah, so this is something that's not actually very well studied. There's some work on some fences that were put in some of the Balkan states fairly recently, and their impacts on some of the large mammals that were that are sort of being restored and conserved in those regions. You know, a lot of the large mammals that are in Europe that have pretty low populations from all the human use of the landscape, but so in that Balkan region, some of the border fences that have been an issue for stopping movement of those animals. I mean, there's a lot of border fences and walls that have been constructed around the world. One of the things that's hard to assess though is, so these impacts are hard to assess across large scales, just because of the logistical challenges. And also there's often a gap in knowledge about, what those barriers look like across very large, distances that we're talking about. So really we don't know a lot. There's individual studies here and there, but there's not been a lot of large scale work. The Great Wall of China is this, example that's brought up a lot. And I don't think we have a good understanding of that either. You know, one thing I will say about that though is that, that's one that, you know, at various times has had many openings in it, or sort of come down and then been restored. But you know, what's being proposed currently to go along the U.S.-Mexico border would be something that would be impenetrable for wildlife. And another important context to put all this these issues in is that of what's happening outside of barrier building to these wildlife, to these species. And that's that we have other issues going on, like habitat destruction and climate change, all things that influence populations that, that humans are doing. And so if we're trying to understand how humans are impacting something, we need to think of them in that context. And so if you go back to the, you know, time of the Great Wall of China, human impacts were of lesser magnitude, so that something, you know, like that, it's probably less likely it would have as many impacts or as many sort of as dramatic impacts in terms of putting species at risk of extinction, because a lot of species along the, for example, U.S.-Mexico border are already at risk of extinction because of other things that people have been doing. And so this sort of piles on to that, these new barriers and walls that they're putting up. That sort of adds to that. And the unfortunate situation is that it's doing that in a way that we don't know what the impacts are because of the legislation, because of how the law is.
You know, it's I've written about previous mass extinctions and how one of the things that's even worse about this one than previous ones is that it is much more multifactorial than simply climate change. That in addition to dealing with climate change, they also have to deal with endocrine disruptors. They've got to deal with pollution. They have to deal with the previous degradation or destruction of their habitat. And then also, they can't simply flee, that at least, you know, the dinosaurs or whomever could try to move north as quickly as possible. And nowadays, they're going to run into Chicago or run into a highway or run into a wall. So I'm just validating what you just said or just agreeing with
you. Yeah, that's one of the things that we didn't really address so much in the study that we did a few years ago. But one thing that's definitely on our mind now as a possible follow-up, which is, you know, we have seen in recent decades a lot of changes in the distribution of organisms as climate shifts, and presumably species that are currently on one side of the U.S.-Mexico border or any other, you know, large border walls. You can imagine that species that are on one side, if they were to track their preferred climates through time, they would need to migrate to the other side of borders. And if you make borders impermeable, as the policy proposal is currently, then you would really prevent that. And you can imagine these species getting squeezed at borders.
So before we talk, I want to talk about one more thing before we move to the Mexico-U.S. border. And that's just fences in general. And I grew up in the West, and like most people who grew up in the rural West, I have in my life seen deer or elk or coyotes who got caught up on barbed wire fences and died. Is this, are little fences, before we get to the big fence down there, which I want to talk about, has there been much study done of smaller fences, just the sort of fencing that we see every day, and that affects on both populations and the larger communities?
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with a lot of work on that. I think, you know, although those, for example, barbed wire fences do sometimes catch organisms, you know, mammals or whatnot in them, I think that that's probably a much lesser magnitude impact than what we're thinking about currently. That's not to say that it's not potentially important. I just, I'm less familiar with that as a major threat. And it's, I don't think it's something that, is currently considered a major conservation threat in areas where you have a lot of barbed wire fencing.
That's pretty much what I thought too, is it's more, I mean, it's certainly a tragedy for the individual animal, but I think it, I've also seen, you know, any number of deer just hop fences easily.
That's right.
So let's move to the border, and let's talk for a moment about the current wall and the proposed extensions. So what sort of scale are we talking about? What physically would we be describing?
Well, so currently what exists is a real mix of designs. In some places, they took old steel helicopter landing mats and they propped them up to make fencing. Some of the newer things that were made following the Secure Fence Act of 2006 had a few different designs. One where they put in what's called vehicle. So they refer to some barriers as vehicle barriers and other as pedestrian barriers. Some of the vehicle barriers look like just little posts in the ground, or also what they call Normandy barriers, which are these metal fences that are fairly short. They're about waist high or so, but that prevent vehicles from driving over them.
And from a wildlife perspective, we don't much care about those, do we?
Yeah, the impacts of those should be pretty small, I would think, compared
to
other things.
The building and maintenance, of course.
Yeah, so that's one aspect of it. But, you know, generally we think those, at least in terms of their impediments to movement, shouldn't be much. And then so in the category of pedestrian fences, that's includes things that are concrete walls that were already constructed, mostly along the Rio Grande. In some places they essentially took the opportunity to make fences that also are levees. And so they're, you know, maybe, I don't know, 15 feet or so of concrete wall with a fence on top of that, with metal fencing on top of that to prevent people from getting over that initial distance. And then some of things are just what they call bollard fences, which are these metal posts that are put very close together that prevent people from walking through. And they're all, you know, they're maybe 15 feet high or so, 20 feet high. I'm not sure the exact heights because they vary, but that's kind of the mix of things that are out there right now. You know, Trump during the campaign and subsequently has talked about how he wants to make something that's impenetrable, you know, something that sounds like it would be concrete and 30 feet tall. You know, that's something that would stop any, pretty much any animal that can't fly, and even a lot of flying animals don't like to go up high because the smaller ones, you know, are very vulnerable to predation from hawks and owls and things. So, you know, that kind of a barrier or wall that they would put in, would be a lot more, would have a lot stronger impacts on wildlife, even beyond what's out there. You know, that would stop everything.
And currently, I'm just, you know, whatever you can sort of estimate as roughly as you want, what percentage of, and we're talking from the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific Ocean, right?
Yeah.
And so what percentage of that would you say is currently covered by a wall that would have a somewhat significant impact on wildlife movement? 1%, 10%, 3%, 90%? I don't know.
So currently, from what was already put in, I'd estimate, you know, something like 20% maybe has barriers that would be major impediments to wildlife. You know, those numbers are a little hard to put your finger on because a lot of mileage along the border is made up of the Rio Grande River, which is sort of meandering back and forth. So, you know, you chuck up a lot of miles kind of in that meander. But, you know, there's several hundred miles of pedestrian fence that were put in, mostly along the coastal regions and also some in southern Arizona.
And is the proposal, if Trump got everything he wanted, would we then be talking about 100% or
90%? Yeah, that's what he's called for. That's, you know, really unrealistic, even if they were given carte blanche to do this, because the, you know, a lot of these areas have pretty steep mountains and the costs would become really sky high. In addition, the Texas border is mostly owned by private landowners. And so a lot of them have already started suing, and a lot of them did sue after the Bush administration started trying to build down there. So, you know, in terms of what's realistic, what he's likely to get is really hard to pin down right now, but one thing that's probably indicative of the challenges faced is that there's not a single congressperson from the border region who represents the border districts or a border state who supports the construction of these barriers. So that's from both parties. So that's, I think, a pretty important lesson for trying to guess what's likely to happen, despite the campaign pledges.
So does the, and I'm sorry that this is such an ignorant question, but does the Rio Grande already present a significant barrier to wildlife movement? If we drop humans out of this equation for a moment, mm-hmm. so we go back, or at least drop industrial humans, so we go back mm-hmm. 600 years, was the Rio Grande a significant barrier to migration at that point, or is the barrier the problem there? The point is, adding a wall to that, does that significantly then, I'm just wondering, because so often, you know, coastal areas and lowlands are the prime habitat for many creatures.
Mm-hmm.
But then also rivers make barriers. So how did that play out?
Yeah, it's, you know, in a lot of places, the Rio Grande is a pretty narrow river, actually. So I don't think that there's much evidence that it's had a major impact on the types of organisms that are on either side because of their ability to move back and forth. You know, if you go to bigger rivers, you do see those kinds of patterns. Like if you go to the Amazon, for example, which can be very wide in some places, in many places. But in a lot of places, the Rio Grande is less than 10 yards apart, 10 yards across. Some places, you know, so that's sort of getting out into West Texas. It's very narrow like that down, the Rio Grande Valley, you know, maybe a few hundred yards at most. So it's really not a very wide river in a lot of these places.
So, let's now talk a little bit about, you mentioned jaguars. Can you talk about who is already affected by the current wall? And who would be affected by a larger wall? Talk about some specifics if you don't mind.
Sure. So we think that currently there should already be some negative impacts on for example, jaguar, because that's a species that, you know, formerly ranged across the Southwest of the United States and bred across the Southwest, including even into Louisiana, for example, but those populations were hunted out, you know, almost 100 years ago. But there are still populations in northern Mexico, in the western part of northern Mexico. So, you know, you have a few individual jaguars that have been coming back across the border across the years, and those individuals definitely rely on breeding populations in northern Mexico. So that would stop if you were to, you know, put these barriers across. And there are already, you know, a fair number of pedestrian barriers in southern Arizona. And those are barriers that, you know, even if they have small openings in them, that's the kind of thing that if it stops a person, it's going to stop a jaguar. And you also have, things like ocelot in South Texas. You know, you've got some small populations of endangered ocelot, which is another tropical cat. These populations are isolated, and, you know, that's a pretty intensely agricultural landscape already. So there's probably pretty rare movement of those individuals through that agricultural landscape back with populations in Mexico, although there are people working on, you know, enhancing natural vegetation to promote that kind of ocelot movement. But that's a region where they've already installed in the lower Rio Grande Valley. They've already installed a fair number of pedestrian fences and walls in the first round of this. And if they were to go forward, that would be, you know, that would definitely stop any of that further movement. Yeah, I don't know if, is that kind of helping out? So in the California coast, for example, this is a region again where you already had a lot of urbanization. but it's also a really biologically important region because we have a lot of species that are endemic to the California coast. You know, once you get up over the California coastal mountains and go inland, you get some very dry deserts. So you have a lot of species that are specialized and endemic to that California coastal region. And a lot of them are already at risk of extinction or threatened with extinction. And that's a region where they put up a lot of pedestrian fences, essentially pedestrian fence most of the way across that California coastal eco region in the first round of construction. And yeah, I don't know if this sort of helps illustrate some of the specifics.
Great. This is all great. This is, I think, very informative for people. And what about with the actual concrete barriers? I know that you probably have your hands full with studying the more charismatic megafauna, but it seems to me that, in addition, this would be devastating to all sorts of smaller creatures who might migrate too. I'm thinking of salamander or frog migrations.
Yeah.
And even insect migrations. Once again, I recognize there is only so much money to be able to study so many types of creatures, but do you know anything about that too?
Yeah, so we in our study, we were very interested in taking a look at all vertebrate species because that's what we really had good information on, and we thought they would be most likely to be impacted in terms of their movement. And a lot of those long-term impacts that I talked about earlier in our conversation, where, you know, allowing organisms to disperse across the landscape can be critical to maintaining a species because, you know, if a population goes extinct, and individuals from other populations can refound that population. You know, that's a kind of process that we think is really important for a lot of species that are often pretty small bodied. Things like amphibians or reptiles. You know, and in the Southwest of the U.S. and along the Mexican border, we have a lot of species like that, that are restricted to very small regions that are often already threatened. For example, on California coast, you have things like arroyo toad, which is a threatened species that now, you know, previous threats may have largely been from habitat destruction, but now we're talking about also over the long term stopping movement back and forth across the border. Which, you know, over the long term, we think would be potentially a major impact or a major threat to survival of the species. So, you know, for those smaller species, where, you know, there's often really not large populations and they're only in a sort of small region, we think those are most vulnerable to actual extinction. We talk about the megafauna because it's easy for people to think about, the impacts that an individual puma might face by not being able to cross the border to find food. But that's an impact that's relatively immediate. But, you know, puma and jaguar, you know, these are species that range across very large, you know, they're distributed across large areas. So puma's not going to go extinct because of this, and jaguar's not going to go extinct. You know, those things are found because of these barriers, because they're found across such large areas. But, you know, these endemic species that are usually pretty small-bodied things like amphibians and small mammals and reptiles. Those are ones that over the long term we think are potentially a bigger risk for extinction because of a lack of movement across the landscape, especially along the border.
We haven't yet talked about the effects of this sort of massive construction project. You mentioned it, but do you want to talk about that more? Have you studied that too?
We haven't specifically, but you know, the main thing that I'll say about that, I think, is that we typically have environmental review processes that go into effect. You know, studies that are carried out anytime you have major construction projects or major infrastructure projects, and you know, these kind of reviews and studies are keeping with environmental regulatory law that we built up as a society, as a country over decades, and that we did those things for good reasons, I think. And the very distinct characteristic of border fences and border walls is that the Secretary of Homeland Security can ignore all of that law. So, Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act, Antiquities Act, any regulatory law whatsoever can be ignored by the Secretary of Homeland Security in the construction of these border barriers. And that's a part of the Real ID Act of 2005. And so what that means is that, you know, usually any big construction project, you would first take a look and say, well, what are we going to be disturbing here? And, you know, how can we mitigate that? Or, you know, how important are these disturbances? That doesn't have to happen at all here. And it didn't happen with the Bush administration's construction.
And that means it's not, not only is there no administrative appeal, there's no judicial appeal.
Well, I mean, there's a lawsuit that the Center for Biological Diversity filed just recently, in conjunction with some members of the House of Representatives from the region, but there were not any successful legal challenges that happened under the Bush administration, and I'm skeptical that that there's a judicial route to stopping this either, just based on the blanket, the very broad authority that's given under the Real ID Act.
So let's pretend that Trump gets his fantasy and that he's going to build a big concrete/metal barrier that does run from sea to shining sea. And this would seem to be a construction project that would be pretty big. And do we have any idea? I mean, I'm guessing this would take orders of magnitude more than, say, the Grand Coulee Dam or Hoover Dam. I mean, the point is, it seems like are there any comparisons for how large this construction project would be? It seems like it would be comparable to parts of the interstate highway system or something, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's the only thing that I can sort of think of as a similar parallel, where it goes across so many different jurisdictions and so many different landholders, and it involves a substantial amount of work. You know, that I think that would be the closest parallel for what we're talking about here. The one interesting, you know, facet of this that explains why there's a lot of resistance in Texas is that actually once you go west of Texas into New Mexico, Arizona, and California, the federal government owns a strip of land along the border that's called the Roosevelt Reservation. It's, I don't know, 100 yards wide, maybe. I can't remember the specific width, but it's very narrow, but it's just enough to, in most of the places, allow the federal government to do this without having to get condemnations of private landowners' land to do it. But in Texas, the great majority of it is in private hands. And so, you know, it becomes a much more challenging battle, and I'm not really too familiar with, you know, what went on in the construction of interstate highways and along those lines, but probably is a useful comparison.
So I know that your emphasis is on environmental stuff as opposed to socio-political stuff, but do you happen to know why why this is so unpopular among even representatives along the border? I mean, you would think that in at least some town in Arizona, there would be a representative who would be in favor of this because some of his constituency is very opposed to immigration.
Yeah, I think that there's a few things involved. I think one is that people who don't live along the border often overestimate the level of violence that occurs in border communities, at least on the U.S. side. So, you know, a lot of these U.S. Border communities are some of the safest in the country. So that's one side of it. You know, El Paso is actually a very safe city, despite the fact that Ciudad Juarez across the border has seen a lot of violence. So that's one part of it. I think another part of it is that the barriers are really very ineffective. People are very ingenuous, and you know, there's a reason why we've been able to do so much as a species that wild animals would not be able to do to get through this barrier. But, you know, once they started building metal fences, they very quickly have to, the Homeland Security had to invest a lot in maintaining those because people come out there with, torches to cut holes in it. And, you know, people build tunnels and, you know, the experience with that's been seen in the Middle East along the, Israel-Palestine border, you know, with tunnel building, you know, really highlights how easy it is to build undetected tunnels. And, you know, if you're talking about the U.S.-Mexico border, we've got hundreds of miles of desert where there's really, it's not very well monitored. So it's very easy to build tunnels out there or to build ladders to go over, catapults people build, people learn to climb the fences. They're really very ineffective.
Two things. One of them is I saw a picture the other day about that had like problem and it showed a wall and then solution and it had a ladder that cost $30 at Home Depot. Right. And the other one is, I mean, we all have heard these stories about these tunnels that are very, that are used and actually quite sophisticated to bring in cocaine or marijuana. And so it just seems like I'm just again agreeing with you on how everything I've heard is it's not tremendously, even if we argue that stopping immigration from Mexico is a good idea, that this is just not a very effective means to do so.
Yeah, I think it's pretty widely recognized in those communities that, you know, what are effective strategies and what are not effective strategies. And it's very clear that these kind of barriers that look good in photo ops are really very ineffective.
Well, it should be a really great barrier to keep all the illegal jaguars out.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the sad part of it is that, you know, people are it's very easy for people to defeat these things, but the jaguar is not, you know, even if they could dig, they wouldn't, you know, think to dig 10 feet underground and, you know, or that's really the only option for something like that. And it's, yeah, there's nothing really that something like that could do, or smaller animals for that matter.
And as long as we're talking about this, you mentioned earlier the lights, and I know your specialty is not light pollution, but do you happen to know what effects that might have on wildlife as well, to have those extremely, the what did you call them? The floodlights?
Yeah, stadium lighting.
The stadium lighting. And that seems to be that it would really have some extremely harmful effects on whoever is out there at night.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty widely recognized in, you know, studying wildlife movement that, you know, lots of animals like to move in the dark and under cover of vegetation, you know, so that they're not seen by predators, or if they're predators, you know, so that their prey don't see them. So, you know, the bright light, you know, so there's a reason why a lot of animals are active at night. And so if you put up bright lights, that really scares them away. And if you destroy the natural vegetation, you know, that also really limits the movement of those animals out into the open.
We have about 10 minutes left, so I'd like to start winding down. And
sure.
I don't know that it's quite time for this yet, but what can people do if somebody cares about jaguars or arroyo toads, what can they do both on this larger issue? And then that's the first question. And then the second question is going to be about smaller barriers, but we'll talk about that in a moment. So first on this issue, what can people do?
I mean, I think policy wise, the key consideration here that would really solve a lot of these issues, or would dramatically improve a lot of these issues, would be if the Real ID Act provision that allows Secretary of Homeland Security to waive all regulatory law, if that were to be repealed. I mean, that I think would place these kind of projects back into the normal sphere of anything we do, either governmental or non-governmental, so that we can properly study impacts of our actions. And you know, so that I think is the number one policy change that would be, I think, help alleviate a lot of these biodiversity threats. Yeah.
And then so far as the, and it sounds to me, let me know if this is wrong, but it sounds to me like what you're suggesting or what your perspective is that this, that Trump is actually not likely to get his wish on this, and it might not be as, it is as big a threat if it actually occurs, but it might not actually occur. Is that reasonably accurate? Or do you think that he'll be able to get great parts of it built?
Well, it's just complicated. So, I mean, you know, what he was promising was extremely, was really extreme. You know, so he's promising an impenetrable wall, across the entire border. Now, that's far, far, far beyond what's there currently. But even if he wasn't to get that, you know, so they've already, had some success, that has actually been misreported a lot, at least from my perspective, in terms of wildlife movement. So in the budget deal, that was recently agreed to fund the rest of, 2017 fiscal year, you know, it was widely reported that there's no money for the border wall. And it's true that there's no money for wall to be constructed in places where there was nothing before, but there was, I'm trying to pull up the number, but I don't have it in front of me. I want to say something like $150 million. There was about that much, there was something like that much money to convert vehicle fence into pedestrian fence. So pedestrian fence, you know, that can include things that are essentially impenetrable walls. And going from that vehicle fence, which is something that we're not too concerned about in terms of animal movement. So that was, you know, a compromise, presuming that, you know, that a lot of, representatives wouldn't necessarily have supported, but, you know, did, I'm guessing, in the interest of the, you know, the compromise that's required to pass the budget agreement. So, you know, I could see that, and, you know, this is even sort of something that I imagine could have been possible, under, the Obama administration, which is, you know, that's current. It's often been talked about in negotiations for immigration overhauls that one part of immigration overhaul would be strengthening of the border. And, you know, that could happen in different ways, but you could imagine that some deal that, you know, gives a path to citizenship for, the many undocumented immigrants who are currently in the country also, puts money into building some more of these walls. And I could see that kind of thing happening. So it's not clear, you know, what kind of scope we're talking about there. It's not, you know, it's unclear what kind of money would be involved. That's a pretty complicated political question, but, I definitely, you know, just as we've seen with this fiscal year, 2017 budget, you know, there is, still movement happening on this, even though it's likely to be at a much smaller scale than Trump promised. But the promises that he made were, you know, really ridiculous in terms of their feasibility, you know, totally unfeasible, I would say.
You know, you and I haven't talked about, the sort of metaphysical aspect or the philosophical aspect of this, that, the insanity of building artificial barriers along completely human-made lines that have nothing to do with the natural world. And just in some ways, the whole wall, the building of an impenetrable wall is, I don't know, it's almost like the central metaphor of this culture of building this completely artificial thing that's actually not even going to accomplish the purposes that they state it will accomplish. And in so doing, you're devastating, you're impinging the ability of non-humans to survive. It seems like there's a metaphor in there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I often think of this because, you know, people have talked about, well, you know, what, couldn't we put little openings in the wall that allow animals to move through, or, you know, could we put some natural vegetation along the wall or something? But, you know, those kind of things, are really counter to what a lot of what the Border Patrol is trying to do. You know, they want to be able to see things. So they want to have lighting. They want to have no vegetation there. And so it kind of gets at the fact that both people who are crossing and also animals who are crossing, want to move undetected in the dark and under cover of vegetation or whatever. But, so those two things are fundamentally at odds. It's really hard to sort of pull those two apart. And, it seems to me that, you know, there are other ways, to approach the policy, questions here, you know, like things that people can do to, remove pressure, on the human side of people crossing undocumented, you know, that seems to me a much, more sound strategy than this one that, is technically challenging and also results in this fundamental conflict between humans and wildlife.
And, you know, we're running out of time, but we also have not talked about the effects of continuously spraying herbicides along a swath of land, too. That can't be a good thing.
Yeah, that could be. You know, and again, that's like one of the many detailed aspects of these kinds of projects that normally you would want subject to some regulatory law, you know, so that if there were negative impacts that, you know, you could, you know, say your drinking water is getting contaminated or something, you know, you could sue in court normally. You can't, for this though, at least under things like Clean Water Act, you know, the only rules that apply if the Secretary of Homeland Security chooses, the only rules that apply are those in the Constitution. And beyond that, they can waive the rest of the legislation that we've built up over the decades.
So really the last question I want to ask is to take this, what can you say to people that will help them to, understand the importance not only of animal movement having to do with this particular border wall, but I'm thinking about highways, I'm thinking about roads, I'm thinking about the time 25 years ago when I saw an entire salamander migration wiped out on a busy road. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about how can we look at animal migrations differently having to do with the barriers that humans create. Is there anything you want to say about that?
You know, I think it's just... maybe useful, you know, if you're sort of thinking, you know, looking at the landscape around you, useful sort of to think about, you know, how would an animal move through this landscape? And do you see animals moving through this landscape? You know, you can try to just imagine things a little bit from animal perspective. And a lot of people, I think, intuitively can understand things that, would or would not favor animal movement. And, you know, these animals that we're conserving already, things that are threatened perhaps, you know, these often play important roles in ecosystems and, you know, humans benefit from those ecosystems. And we also have some aesthetic pleasure we get from wildlife and natural ecosystems. So, you know, I think those are some of the reasons to consider for conservation of salamanders and their movement, for example, where, you know, some people might say, oh, I don't really benefit much from salamanders, but, you know, we know that, you know, ecosystems are complicated and their functioning often depends on many, of the smaller components that people often are ignorant of.
Well, thank you so much for doing the interview, and thank you for your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jesse Lasky. This is Derek Gentry from Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.